perhaps the system is changing, that we are reducing the need for high-stakes testing as a consequence of how the pandemic is changing schooling?
I'm not sure what all states did, but in Virginia, when we closed schools in March of 2020, we did not administer the test that spring. But throughout last year, when schools were open and closed and open again and remote and hybrid, we still tested our students in the spring. We went right back to testing. And in fact, for this year, we're adding in an additional test. We're going to start doing fall testing in reading and math in addition to spring testing.
If you had one final appeal to lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, in all states who have some control over this and at the national level, what would you ask them to consider?
What is the purpose of our education system? When we look at profiles of a graduate, when we look at school mission statements, we see the language there. We know what people want out of schools. But that's not the schools. We don't have schools designed to do that. Most states in the country now have what's called a profile of a graduate, where they kind of lay out, here's what a student should look like when they leave our schools. And they're all lofty, wonderful ideals. We focus on what's called the five C's: critical thinking, creative thinking, communication, collaboration, and civic mindedness. All of those are great things. That's what we say we want our students to have when they leave, but we don't measure that. We measure isolated chunks of content through 50-question multiple choice tests. I would encourage those members of legislature, to go look at these pockets of excellence that we have, to read Ted Dinter-Smith's What School Could Be, to read Scott McCloud and Dean Shoresky, Different Schools for a Different World, to watch the documentary Most Likely to Succeed, and we can see examples of excellence that inspires, most of all, students to excellence, but also inspires educators to bring their students to such excellence.
Well, Brad Bissell, this has been an uplifting conversation. Thank you for talking with me and with good reason.
Thank you, Sarah. It was a pleasure to be here.
Brad Bissell is a professor of education at Radford University. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is With Good Reason. When many parts of life came to a halt two springs ago, nature still did her thing. The dogwoods bloomed, the leaves returned to trees, and the birds sang their songs. And many of us found we had the time to pay attention to nature. Alan Forrest is a professor of psychology at Radford University. He's long led Mindfulness Mondays for his coworkers there, but last year, Mindfulness Mondays became a lifeline for many of his colleagues and students who are home around the country. On that Monday that you and your students first were separated due to COVID, you'd been doing something you call Mindfulness Mondays for faculty and staff for years before the pandemic hit. Tell me what those were and what they were like.
Yeah, so basically what that's like, it's a drop-in session. It's 30 minutes from 12 to 12:30. And it's open to all faculty and staff at the university.
So, where would you do it?
Well, when the weather is nice, everyone loves doing it outside, in the fresh air and the sun, and being able to breathe outside of a building.
Why do you think the pandemic was so hard on people's mental health?
For me, that's an easy one. I think the cruelest part of the pandemic was, as a species, as a human species, as human beings, we connect with family, we connect with friends, we connect with the people we work with. We're social beings, and there was a lack of sense of connection and community and just being in the same space, being with people. And to me, that was the number one thing, and that was hard. That was really, really hard for most of us.
So when the shutdown came and we went from in-person classes to Zooms, you took your weekly meditation with faculty and staff and made that something that ended up being a lot larger, but online.
Correct. It was online, and we did a number of different things. I've been also doing for the last 4 or 5 years just a student mindfulness meditation practice session once a week. And we do that at the Fitness and Wellness Center here on campus. We continue to do that. We just transitioned that to the Zoom format. And then what we also did, myself and a colleague, was open up a weekly session for graduate students. And then the other thing that I did was what I call the faculty support group, once a week via the Zoom format, and just talk about some of the challenges, struggles, both professionally in their role as college professors, but also personally, the struggles they were experiencing with their students. Trying to really connect with the students who were struggling. Some students were living at home, parents had lost jobs, and they had to go out and work. Students were struggling. Several students live in impoverished areas. They may live in far southwest in the Appalachian area where internet is not available. Just attending class via Zoom, they couldn't do it from their house. So they would drive and sit outside of a McDonald's that had Wi-Fi just to attend class. And for some of these folks, they may have had to drive 10, 15 miles.
I guess students were uniquely affected in some ways because they're mostly living alone.
Yes.
And also they're young enough not to understand fully what comes after this. Do we ever get out of it?
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that we know is without having certainty, without knowing what comes next, anxiety arises within us. You know, and I think that was one of the key things, just the not knowing, and then young people in college not having the life experience, you know, that older individuals have in terms of how to navigate that not knowing. People, we all like to have some degree of control as to what comes next and what does this mean for my life. You know, I think about, you know, students who were seniors and, you know, finishing up a 4-year college experience, and they're looking ahead as to what comes next for them in terms of going on to graduate school for those that choose to do that, or others that are securing a job, employment, or embarking on a career.
Why were young people, not all of them, but a few, especially hard hit by the shutdown? Was it that they were alone and isolated?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. We are very social beings, particularly young people where their peer group is so important, not only their families, but also being with their friends and just having too much alone time. Alone time is a good thing, and certainly when we're engaged in a mindfulness meditation practice, we're just allowing ourselves to be with ourselves. but maybe just a little too much time alone and not engage in all the social activities, particularly on a college campus, that college students do.
You said a lot of us were in lockdown with our pets, our beloved pets.
Right.
And actually, that was a great thing, that we should cling to them because they are so healing.
Yeah, yeah. I have a dog and two cats, and I always consider them as my in-home mindfulness meditation teachers, because if you think about it, and we'll just look at our four-legged canine friends, they're always in the moment. They live in the moment. They're non-judgmental. They go with the flow. They accept things as they are. If I'm having a bad hair day, or if my clothes don't match or whatever, it's totally irrelevant. They accept me for the person who I am. And that's one of the things that these practices can do, can help us accept ourselves just the way we are, for who we are, and in doing so, then radiate that outwards to then accept others for the wonderful, beautiful, creative, and oftentimes different individuals that they are.
Did you yourself have any particularly bad days during the pandemic?
Yeah, I have some elderly parents, and they're living in a retirement community, and those areas were hard hit. I was very concerned about them. I was concerned about my students. Some of them live in family situations or living situations that may not be ideal, and they were kind of locked down with them. You know, there were some tough times where I, just because I practice mindfulness meditation, it doesn't mean that I don't get stressed out as well. And there was so much uncertainty and not knowing in my lives, and information changed from one moment to the next. But one of the things that really helped keep me grounded was looking out my window, or better yet, going out in my yard. And it was springtime, it was mid-March, and here in Southwest Virginia, you know, the mountains and the trees and the meadows and the flowers and grasses, everything began to bloom. When all facets of our lives, all domains of our lives were impacted by the pandemic, you know, nature was still doing her thing, and spring came, and the dogwoods bloomed, and the daffodils came up, and the grass turned green, and leaves came out on the trees. And I found that to be a very comforting thing, because that was normal when just about every other part of my life seemed to be changed in some way.
I think we all felt that way about spring. Spring felt so especially welcome, beautiful, hopeful, and all enveloping, right?
Mm-hmm. And what made it maybe a particularly good spring is that we were really paying attention to it, right?
Yes.
Mindfulness is all about paying attention on purpose in the present moment and without judging it. And we can just embrace the majesty and beauty and the show that nature puts on every spring. And I would submit, you know, every season is beautiful. It's different, but it's all got its wonder, joy, and beauty in its own way.
Do you actually teach a course on mindfulness at Radford?
Yes, we have an undergraduate course as well as a graduate level course in my program, which is a counselor education program. And I think for young people, whether they know it or not, there's a thirst or hunger for having periods of silence and stillness in their lives. All of our lives, but particularly college students' lives, are very hurried, harried, busy. They're always moving, doing, and going. And we live in this overstimulated world, and with our devices, there's always things happening. And they really like the notion of being what we call unplugged for a little while, and just allow themselves to sit and to be present with whatever is arising for them.
Do you think we should be giving them this experience earlier in their undergraduate education?
Yeah, one of the things that many of the students say, and oftentimes they take the intro to mindfulness meditation course, which has no prerequisites, but they take it in their last semester in college because they've fulfilled all their required courses. And one of the comments that I hear over and over again is, I wish I had taken this course when I was a freshman, because in it I've learned how to more skillfully manage how I respond rather than react to events. And it also allows them a little oasis of inner peace and calm in their lives. And they've learned how to do that.
I can't imagine a greater gift, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a life skill that I think they can carry with them. In fact, one of our students a few years ago, she was going on an interview for grad school. And so we still had a month left in the course. And she went on the interview and came back. And she was so excited because she said, you know, I was really nervous before I was getting interviewed, but I just sat in the waiting room before going in. There were two people that were going to talk to me. I just closed my eyes and brought my focus to my breath, and it really calmed me down so that when I went in there, I could be very attentive and responsive to the questions that they were asking. So she utilized in the moment what she had learned in that class. And so it was very gratifying to me as a meditation teacher to hear her say that and use it. Because these skills that we're teaching them are not to just sit by themselves in their rooms in formal meditation, but to bring these practices into their everyday life.
Yeah. Well, Alan Forrest, thank you for sharing your insights with me and With Good Reason.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure sharing these practices with you today.
Alan Forrest is a professor of psychology at Radford University. Last year, millions of American students left the classroom to prevent the spread of a virus. Some didn't return for nearly 2 years. There's really no precedent for that. And young adults returning to classrooms now are feeling, well, a lot. My next guest is Robert McNabb, a professor of economics at Old Dominion University. He says students need support processing the past year and returning to class. Robert, many students have been isolated this year and a half, really. What do you think is the most urgent mental health need for students returning to classrooms in the fall?
So right now, if we're standing here in August and we're thinking about students who are just going back to class in some states or are looking forward to going back into class, the worst thing we can do is to bring them back, have an outbreak, and then send them back to remote learning. That disruption, that uncertainty has an unestimable toll. We just don't know how bad the toll of mental health is, and it creates untold costs now and into the future.
How have your own children responded to masking in the classroom? Do they hate it, or are they resigned to it?
Well, my experience with my kids has been a non-issue. It has been, we got to wear a mask, but we get to go to school. It's not a big deal.
What did you notice during the year and a half we were in sort of shutdown mode in your own children? How old are they, and what stressors did you see them going through?
Well, I have an adult now. He just graduated from high school. And I have two teenagers, one that is in high school and one that is in middle school. What I noticed is all three entered into the pandemic in relatively good academic standing. We had issues, but those issues were, did you complete your homework on time or spend more time on video games than we asked you to? When we transitioned to remote schooling, that structure was ripped away from us. That ability to say, okay, your day begins at 7, You get on the bus, you go to school, you come home, you do all your homework, and then your time is yours. And this was just not us. We, in talking with other parents, we saw this time and time again. Even relatively high performing students tended to struggle at times. And if your child had a learning disability or was already behind academically, the pandemic just compounded the problem.
So bad as it was for your family, your children, there are other children also experiencing much deeper mental health crises. Can you talk about what seems to have caused those stressors that has led to the crises for these others?
Yes. One thing I have to say from my personal experience is that I have been extremely fortunate. The worst problem we encountered was that our kids would not turn in work at time. We would figure it out and then spend a week catching back up. We did not have a child who exhibited symptoms of anxiety or significant depression.
And you didn't lose your job or life.
Right. Yeah, my life was fairly stable. For families that experienced a COVID shock, that is, somebody in the family was infected or hospitalized or unfortunately died, or an economic shock, they lost their job, their hours were reduced, or just the combination of those two, the kids no longer had that structured environment of the school, which provided a modicum of safety. That disappeared. They were home. They saw the stress. They saw the public health toll. They saw relatives getting sick. They never had an opportunity to move out of that environment.
What about mental health resources? Even before the pandemic, I had a friend whose young nephew was spiraling into drugs in bad circumstances. His mother was desperate to get him into treatment before it went even farther, but there was nothing available. Appointments were months away, and her problem was immediate. Is that common, even in the better times pre-pandemic?
Prior to the pandemic in Virginia, we already were facing a mental health crisis. We were obviously underfunding mental health for youth and adults. If you think about the current discussions about the rise in homelessness in the United States, the evidence time and time again comes back to many of the homeless who are long-term homeless have persistent mental health and substance abuse disorders. And those two are interdependent. And we have to ask ourselves, when do we start thinking about mental health disorders like we think about cholesterol or cancer or breaking a leg, right? It's not like, oh, you have a bone sticking out of your leg. We know you. We should call an ambulance. And so we don't resource it accordingly. Now, 18 or so months into a pandemic, we have to ask ourselves, what's happened to access to those mental health resources for children and youth?
Right.
And their primary access point where they can get referred to services in many cases is through the school system. But now they're looking at the school system through a screen. And that face-to-face interaction, that learning students' habits and behaviors, that system of support disappeared. And so the problem where parents were trying to find resources prior to the pandemic just became even worse.
What do you think our biggest mental health needs are? Do we need big state mental hospitals, small counseling centers, residential treatment programs, school guidance counselors? Where should our dollars go?
Yes. I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it is not expensive, in my opinion, to invest in mental health now relative to investing in jails and hospitalizations in the future.
So what do you think we should do next? How can we ensure that we're prioritizing student mental health?
We know the federal government has provided extra funds to states through the COVID relief packages to be used fairly broadly at the state's discretion. In Virginia, we're seeing increased investments in mental health resources. Up to $500 million has been proposed. If that passes, that would be a very significant investment, but it's one-time money. The question then becomes, does the state decide to keep that level of funding in the future, or is this a one-time injection? And so every state is facing this question. You have new money from the federal government. Where do you invest that? Do you invest in roads? Do you invest it in jails? Do you invest it in people? And if you're going to invest it in people, obviously, given the mental health toll of the pandemic, youth and adult mental health services is the way to go. But one of the worst things you can do is to use that new money to scale up a bunch of services to provide people hope and a modicum of treatment, and then go, oh, funding's over, we're done. So if we're going to do this, we need to do it right in a sustained way. So it's a good first step in Virginia and other states to invest in mental health. The real question then becomes, does it get locked into future budgets? Or is this just one-time money that makes everybody essentially feel good? And then in 2 years, we applaud ourselves from having to address the problem and move on when we haven't addressed the problem in the long term at all.
Thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you very much.
Robert McNabb is a professor of economics at Old Dominion University. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
of you makes my heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring. And you appear in all your splendor, my one and only love. The shadows fall and spread their mystic charms in the hush of night while you're in my arms. I feel your lips so warm and tender, my one and only love. The touch of your hand is like heaven, a heaven that I've never known. The blush on your cheek whenever I speak tells me that you are my own. You fill my eager heart with such desire, every kiss you give.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday nights, midnight to 3 a.m. Sound.